the royal diadem and crown him Lord of all.
Turn to the book of Hebrews. We will finally make it to chapter 10 this morning. And even though there are folk who accuse me of moving slowly through books of the Bible, I'm going to back up a little bit this morning. Because last week we spent some time in the last portion of chapter 9, and I purposefully moved past one of the big themes, because it would really have taken too long to take the time to introduce that theme last week. So we're going to start there this morning. Let me introduce you to another Greek word in English letters, H-A-P-A-X. This word, hapax, is actually a word that has migrated into the English language those of you who have spent any time in literary circles, and boy, isn't that all of us, may have heard of something called the Hopox legomenon. No? Nothing? Nothing? The only reason I bring it up, well, two reasons. Number one, the word legomenon can also be pronounced legomenon, which makes me want to go do-do-do-do-do. But
wow.
I know. Somebody better. Hopox legomenon, the only reason that I bring this up is that what that refers to in literature is when a particular writer or author uses a particular word one time and only one time. This Greek word hopox means once, but it means more than just once. It means once and only once. And the writer of Hebrews is now going to use that word several times in order to stress the fact that unlike all of the Old Testament sacrifices and the yearly sacrifices and the daily sacrifices, unlike the constant stream of blood that flowed from the tabernacle in the wilderness, unlike the repetition that God required in the law of sacrifice of goats and of bulls and of doves and of sheaves of offerings and of tithes and of drink offerings, unlike all of that, the enormous contrast in the new covenant is the sacrifice was done hapax, once and only once. And he's going to argue that the evidence of the sufficiency of the finished work of Christ is that it was done once and only once. He's even going to argue that had it not been fully and completely sufficient, then it would have had to be repeated. And so, for 1,400 years, Israel continued to sacrifice the same sacrifices over and over and over again, demonstrating that none of them ever actually accomplished full redemption or completion. Many of your translations will translate it as perfection. Nothing was ever perfected by the old covenant. Didn't matter how many animals were brought through the temple, didn't matter how much blood flowed, there was still never going to be an end to it. There was never going to be a finish to the sacrifices because all the sacrifices ultimately could do, he's going to argue, was repeatedly declare how sinful Israel was because they had to keep doing it. One thing that the sacrifices could not do, we saw last week, is that it could never cleanse the conscience of the knowledge of sin. In fact, what it did was remind the conscience of the reality of sin, because things had to keep dying. I have debated before with folks who don't like the Bible, folks who want to denigrate the Bible, and one of the common arguments from the critics is they say, well, it's just such a bloody book. There's just so much blood in the Bible. Michael's nodding. You've heard that argument, haven't you?
From the Clarence, Slaughterhouse Religion.
Absolutely. And it's just, there's so much blood in the Bible. Do you know why there's so much blood in the Bible? There's so much sin in humanity. The constant flow of blood is a testimony of sinfulness. If there was ever a final end to sin, there would be no more sacrifice. Logic tells you if there's no more sin, there's no more sacrifice for sin. And that's exactly what the writer of Hebrews is going to say. And he's going to use perhaps my favorite word in the New Testament. I love the word grace. I'm very big on grace. I can make entire sentences out of the word grace. Around here, we talk grace. People around here are known to just walk up to someone else and say, grace, 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 grace. And the other person knows what the first person is saying and will respond, yes, grace, 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 grace. We're sovereign grace people. We're Grace Christian Assembly. We're all about grace. Our website is Salvation by Grace. We're very into grace here. But my other favorite word in the New Testament is forgiveness. And the writer of Hebrews is going to argue that because of the nature of the finished work of Christ, because it was done hapax, once and only once. And because God accepted that as full, sufficient payment, therefore there is forgiveness for our sins. And we then, having been forgiven, need no more sacrifice for sins. So the Hebrews writer's logic is the fact that it was done once and only once proves how sufficient it was to accomplish complete forgiveness, therefore, no more sacrifice for sin. You get all that? Because if you ever sit and meditate on it, if you ever stand and meditate on it, I don't care if you lay down and meditate on it, if you ever really meditate on what God did in Christ and that his once-for-all sufficient sacrifice brought about complete and utter forgiveness for sin, that will bring you a peace unlike anything else can. Because you'll know that you are okay with the God who made everything. I've said it before and I'll say it again, and I'll probably keep saying it until the day I die. But we human beings are just a constant mass of insecurities and fears and doubts. It's funny how easily everybody started nodding almost unwillingly. Just, yes, that'd be me, yes, yes. I'm personally convinced that 99.9% of everything we do is just a way of masking our securities from everybody else because we're afraid that if they ever found out what we're really like, they would never talk to us again. And that 0.1% is where you're lying. Because we're just a great big bundle of fears and insecurities. Because we are, after all, fallen creatures. And we are, after all, described in the Bible as dead in trespasses and sins. Our natural state is that we are children of wrath, even as the others, says Paul. And even if you don't know that biblically, you know it intrinsically. And that's where all that insecurity comes from. So what are you going to do? Well, one answer is to turn to drugs, to turn to alcohol, to try to assuage your conscience by just beating it back with chemicals. Or another way you're going to handle it is to try to just fill that void in yourself and in your life with sexual proclivities or just anything to not think about. Another way to cover it up is to just make yourself so busy with the stuff of life that you don't have to think about the fact that God exists and that he's a judge. And so you just keep yourself busy to avoid thinking about things like death and judgment. So you spend all your time watching TV or just doing something to keep your mind numbed so you don't have to think about it. But the best way to get a handle on who you really are and what you're really like and be okay with it is to meditate on this very thing, that the once-for-all finished sacrifice of Christ brought about utter and complete forgiveness, and that you have been completely forgiven of everything you've ever done that was in rebellion against God and his righteousness and his holiness. In other words, you are, if you're in Christ and Christ is in you, you are okay with God. Does anybody remember the book that came out back in the 70s? Let's see how old the crowd is. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you won't remember this book. Anybody here remember the book, I'm Okay, You're Okay? Yeah. I used to argue with that title. I used to go, I'm okay, you're... The whole objective behind I'm okay, you're okay was to deal with that general insecurity that all us humans have. And it approached it from a psychological viewpoint and said that you just need to think positively about yourself and about other people. Sort of that, what was his name? Somebody Smalley looking in a mirror saying, I'm...
Stuart Smalley.
It's that kind of moment. Looking in a mirror and saying, I'm good enough and I'm smart enough and doggone it, people like me. That's that sort of talk yourself into a positive view of yourself. But if anybody ever tried it, you know that that only lasts for a very short time, because you'll be back in front of that mirror the next day saying, no, really, I do like myself, really. And then you'll be back the next day and the next day, because there's never any end game. There's never any peace to staring into your navel and trying to find goodness in you. It's just going to be self-defeating. You're going to recognize over and over and over again that you're simply not good enough. The only place you're going to find real, genuine peace, peace of mind and comfort in this life, is when you realize that the one who made you chose you from before the foundation of the world, sent his son to die for you, and that finished once for all death and resurrection utterly forgives you for being the way you are. I know Joni went, yeah, exactly. That once for all sacrifice utterly forgives you for everything you've done, everything you've thought, every rebellion in your heart, just for being you, for being the way you are, for acting the way you act. All of that is under the blood of Christ once. And that took care of it. And once you get a hold of that, you'll finally exhale. You'll finally go, oh, this good news is really good news. I'm actually really okay. And so you may still be kind of a bundle of nerves and insecurities, because you're human and you're still walking around in this sinful flesh. So you may still struggle with the fact that you're a human, but at least you'll have a place where you can kind of run and hide and find security. It's the tool more than anything else in my life that has given me the strength to get up and go on in the middle of my worst circumstances. Let's do this. Think of the worst thing you've ever done. Go. No, you shouldn't have been that happy about it. You're way too up about that. Yeah. Yeah. Think of the worst thing you've ever done. Think of the thing that you're embarrassed of when you remember it in the middle of the night, and it's only you alone in your bed at night in the dark. Nobody else knows about it, but you know about it, and you can't go back to sleep because you thought of it. You got it? You know what that thing is? Everybody in the room has their thing right now. You're forgiven. Isn't that great? You're forgiven. Your rebellion, all those places where you said things you know you shouldn't have said, all that stuff that your wife still won't forgive you for. God forgave you. We, because we're human, we still want to cling to that stuff. We still want to bring it up and go, oh, you don't know me, though. You don't know where I've been. You don't know what I've done. You don't know me, Jim. I don't need to know. All I know is run to Christ, and his once for all finished sacrifice is sufficient to forgive you utterly and completely. So when we get to chapter 10, verse 14, the language that the writer is going to use is he's going to say that the finished sacrifice of Christ perfected us forever. Well, this is great language.
Yes.
Because not only are we forgiven of everything that the law could not forgive, but where the sacrifice of animals could never perfect anybody, the once for all, the hapax, the finished work of Christ, perfected forever all those that he sanctified or set apart for himself. You've never heard better news in your silly little life than that.
That's right.
And if you can get a hold of that, I promise you, you'll sleep better. You'll parent better. You'll forgive better. Because you'll realize how much you've been forgiven of. And it'll be a whole lot easier for you to forgive. Because we all like to hold on to those things because it appeals to our ego to think, well, you really hurt me and I'm never going to let you and I'm going to get you. That appeals to our ego. That appeals to our pride. Our flesh loves that sense of I'm offended, and now that I've been offended, I'm going to offend you. We love that way of thinking. But if you ever get a hold of, how much God forgave you and how offensive you were. Because after all, let's say that I've done something to offend Wolfgang. And I love Wolfgang. I would never offend Wolfgang on purpose. But let's say I did something to offend Wolfgang. Pardon my saying it this way, but it's just Wolfgang. Right? Because he's also an offensive person. And I'm an offensive person. And you're an offensive person. And you're an and we've all offended God. Now, a minute ago, I said it's just Wolfgang. But when I say God, oh no, it's not just God. It's the righteous, holy, eternal God. It's the God who made everything and lives in absolute splendor. It's the God who has encased himself in a light that no man approaches. It's God who can represent himself any way he wants to represent himself. And so he has angels around his head crying out to one another how holy he is. That God is offended by you. And you have offended him over and over and over and over again. And he forgave you. Now, what can anybody do to you that you can't forgive? Right? If he could forgive you of all that, then whatever that little thing is that you're holding on to, let go of it. And for God's sake, for Christ's sake, and for your own well-being, forgive. All right, that was all introduction. Man, we got to move. Okay. We're in the middle of chapter 9. Let's start in, verse 21. In the same way. We can't start in the same way. That doesn't work at all. Verse 19. Verse 18. Genesis 1:1. I'm glad to know that that joke works every time. Therefore, even the first covenant, this is verse 18, was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and of goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop, and he sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of ministry with blood. And according to the law, one may also say that all things are cleansed with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, which is a mere copy of the true one, but he entered into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God. What are the next two words? For us. Don't you like those words? Rather than the high priests and the Levites that were constantly going into the tabernacle in the wilderness, which was just a foreshadow, which was just a copy. Instead, Christ went into heaven itself and stands before the throne room of God, that unapproachable light I spoke of, that domain of holiness, the holiest place that I spoke of. Christ appeared there, but he appeared there for Devante. He appeared there for Conrad. So what was he doing there for them? Well, this is what he was up to. Nor was it that he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters into the holy place year by year with blood that's not his own. Otherwise, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. What he's arguing is, if Christ's sacrifice required more than one offering, then he would have had to do it constantly, continually, repetitively, since the foundation of the world, in order to save anybody. But now, look at the next word, but now once. But now hapax. Once at the teleo, it's the word for the end of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. The reason he appeared on the planet, the reason he was manifested, was to put away sin through the sacrifice of himself. I like the phrase, put away sin. Because back in the Old Testament, you read phrases like, God has cast our sin as far as the east is from the west. You read David writing in the Psalms and saying, blessed is the man to whom God does not impute sin. So even back there in the Old Testament, under the law, there was still this notion, this concept, this idea that God could forgive sin and he could cast sin away. He could cast it behind his back. He could forget about it. But there was no method for him to actually do that in the law. So Christ came. And when Christ came, he was manifested in the flesh for the very purpose of putting away sin. And so, verse 27, and inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes the judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, shall appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. That's how far we got last week. And we concluded with, I'm eagerly awaiting him. By the way, notice the limitations in that verse. It does say that he is going to appear to those who eagerly await him. That fits the eschatology we believe that Christ is coming back for his people. He's coming back for those who eagerly await him, but notice that when he appears the second time, he's appearing to gather people, to save people. He's not coming back with reference to sin, because the first time he was here, he took care of the sin issue. The first time he was here, he came for the purpose of dying to put away sin. So that issue is settled. That issue is done. That issue is out of the way. And again, it's really hard for us to think that way. Let's try it out. Hey, Russ. Do you feel perfect?
No.
See, that's the right response. Because we're human beings still walking around in this flesh. What Paul calls this body of death. And so we don't feel perfected. We don't feel completed. But in the mind of God, which is the only opinion that counts, in the mind of God, the once for all finished sacrifice of Christ ended the sin issue where you're concerned. Isn't that a relief? Isn't it good to know that as far as God is concerned, that's settled. It's taken care of. The finished work of Christ is done. I still go to God and I fall on my knees sometimes thinking about the things I do and the things I say and the way I act. And I get in front of him and I say, forgive me. You ever do that? Just forgive me. Break down in tears, saying, just God, just forgive me. And then I go back and I read this. And then I stand up and say, thank you. I'm glad to know that Christ has finished the work and I'm forgiven. And he has put my sinfulness away. And not just away, but as far as the east is from the west. That's a long way. By the way, interesting language that, because you can go north far enough that you're headed south again. And so you don't find that he put your sins as far as the north is from the south, because that doesn't work. But you can go east and keep going east for the rest of your life. And so God said, I've cast it as far as the east is from the west. And if you think of it from God's perspective, when he's thinking east and west, he's thinking universe, not just planet. So how far away has he cast your sin? It's just eternally away, eternally gone. And he did it in the once for all finished sacrifice of Christ. Chapter 10, verse 1, this is where we're trying to get. Which means technically this was all still introduction and doesn't count against my time. I apologize to the visitors. Get comfortable. For the law, For the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come, and not the very form of those things, can never, by the sacrifices, by those same sacrifices year by year, which they offer continually, they can never make perfect those who draw near. You could bring your animals over and over and over again. But every animal you brought only testified to the fact that you were sinful, but it couldn't forgive you. All the law can do, I've stressed this so many times, all the law can do is say you're guilty. The law can't bend. The law can't reach down to help you. In fact, when you think you're doing okay, the law will put its leg out and trip you. Because the law will condemn you. That's all the law can do. It can't ever salve your wounds. It can't ever say, that looked painful, let me help. All the law can do is say, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong again, you're wrong again, and now you're wrong. And so the continual bringing of animals and animal sacrifice and blood flowing was a constant testimony to, you're wrong. And it can't ever make you perfect. It can't ever bring you peace between you and God. And yet, I grew up in a church that spent most of its time preaching the law to me. Anyone else? Really? Anyone else? Oh, that's what I thought, yeah. What do I mean by they spent most of the time preaching the law? They spent most of the time defining Christianity by do's and don'ts. Now we're getting somewhere. People are nodding. Yes, our church, in our church, we do these things and we don't do these things. And if you do these things, you're a good Christian and probably heaven bound. And if you don't do these things, and they define their Christianity on that basis. As opposed to defining it biblically, biblical Christianity says you're a sinner and you're depraved and there's nothing good in you and your best righteousness is bloody rags. But Christ is all, and Christ is sufficient, and the sacrifice of Christ is complete, and he gets all the glory and he gets all the honor, which is why I have never tried to define the Christianity of this body based on what you do or how you perform, because to whatever degree you perform well and think you're getting closer to God based on that performance, to that degree you're saying, Christ did most of it, but I filled in the blanks. I did my part. You're wanting to share that throne with God. Well, you can say, well, sure, God did some, but I did mine too. And you get that conception of God as somebody who's up there wanting to do things, wants to save some people, just can't seem to pull it off. Because those people just won't cooperate and do the things that he wants them to do. No. Biblical Christianity says you're incapable of doing anything that would please God. You are incapable of obligating God to save you on the basis of your works. And in fact, when you bring your works in front of him, he's more likely to say, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, I never knew you. Instead, biblical Christianity says, your works are all bad because you're sinful. You're depraved. What do you think you're going to take in front of God that God's going to go, good one? Well done, Kellen. I didn't see that coming. Good job. No, instead, all your works are unclean, but his work is of such a nature that it is utterly and completely perfect and has eternal consequences, and everyone for whom he died is utterly forgiven, completely cleansed, perfected forever, has an eternal inheritance, has eternal life, and therefore we, in response, go out and do good works. Works that are now acceptable to God because it's no longer us doing them to try to obligate God or convince God, it's us doing good works because of what God is doing through us. And he still gets all the glory. That's biblical Christianity. The law can't help you. I keep saying it. The law can't help you. And yet, the vast majority of churches in the world today define their Christianity on the basis of the law that can't help you. And then they want to impose it on your conscience so that they can what? Make you feel worse? As if you don't already feel bad about yourself to begin with. And then they'll even make up rules you don't find anywhere in the Bible. There was a fellow out in Los Angeles, took out a full-page ad in the LA Times. Said, come and hear me preach against these things. And there was a whole list of things that he was going to preach against. Rock and roll, smoking cigarettes, women wearing pants. You know, he had a whole list of things he was going to preach against. He was so proud of that that he took out an ad and told people, come hear me preach against these things. Look, I can tell you all day long things I don't think you ought to be doing. But if I haven't told you about Christ and his finished work, I've done you no good whatsoever. All I've done is heap condemnation on you. You walk in feeling bad, I make you feel worse, and I send you home. No, I want you to come in here feeling bad. I don't mean that sentence to sound the way it just did. I don't mean that I want you to come in here feeling bad. But I want you to come in here knowing that there's an answer. There's a cure for your cancer. There's a solution for how bad you feel. The world will beat you to death. This is sanctuary. I want you to be able to come here and hear about the goodness of God and the finished work of Christ so that you can finally drop your guard. How few places can you go anymore where you can drop that egocentric guard and just be yourself and know that you're going to be accepted because everybody else in the room realizes that they're no better than you anyway and that we're all saved by this common faith that we all share in the finished work of Christ. That's such a good place to be. I don't beat people up. I don't have the jurisdiction to beat people up. But if the Holy Spirit gets a hold of you, you'll know how sinful you are. You won't need me to tell you. Yeah? Yeah. For the law that has only a shadow of good things to come and not the very form of those things can never, by the same sacrifices year by year which they offer continually, make perfect those that draw near. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have any conscience of sin. In other words, if it worked, at some point, they'd have quit it. There'd be some animal they finally killed where they went, well, that did it. We're good. We're clean now. And there would be no more conscience of sin because those sacrifices were a reminder of sin. But if it's accomplished, if it's done, then there's no more reminder of sin. There's no more conscience of sin. We can stop the animals now. And God never let them stop the animals. Verse 3. In those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin year by year. So what was the purpose? What was the purpose of the sacrifice? A reminder of sin. Every time you had to go in there and kill an animal, look, put flesh and blood on it for a moment. Because we're roughly 2,000 years removed from this practice. So it's hard for us to imagine now. Think about the Passover lamb for a moment. Because the Passover practice was a very emotional and bloody practice. First, you had to go get a baby lamb, and then you had to bring it in the house with the family and the kids. And you had to keep it in the house for 3 days. I know. Dwight's going, no. What happens when you have a baby animal in the house with the kids? I know, he's so cute, says our vet's assistant. Yes, he's so cute, little baby lamb. Look, Daddy got us a lamb. Yay! We love the baby lamb. Love the baby lamb. And then, on Passover, Dad is required by God to string up the baby lamb by his back legs in the presence of the family, get a sharp knife, and slice his neck open and catch the blood in a basin and take a bit of hyssop and dip it in the blood and put it on the doorpost of the house. I know, I see your faces. So this is why I'm saying put some flesh and blood on it. That was just one yearly sacrifice. But there were lots of them. There were sacrifices that were connected to all seven of the feast days that were part of their annual calendar. And three times a year, they had to go up to Jerusalem, and they had to make sure they didn't come up empty-handed. They had to bring sacrifices with them to give to the priest. And there had to be sacrifice, there had to be blood, and there had to be constant blood. We think sometimes, oh, once a year, high priest, holy of holies, separated from all the people. They probably didn't see all that. No, no, no. The Jewish life was a constant life of sacrifice and giving and tithing and first fruits and constant remembrances, constant reminders to put God first and be aware of God in your life. And God required all this from them, and it never, ever cleansed their conscience from sin. And they had to keep doing it. But we have our conscience cleansed from sin because of everything I've already said, that the once-for-all finished sacrifice of Christ put away sin. And we're forgiven completely and utterly, and we're perfected forever. Do you see the contrast between the old and the new covenant? This is really what I'm driving at. The contrast is absolutely huge. Why, I ask, why? Why would anyone stand in a pulpit and drive your conscience back to that old covenant that could never cleanse your conscience from sin? Always, I will drive people to Christ and the new covenant and fully sufficient, finished, once for all forgiveness. There's nothing better. There's nothing better. Here, we'll let him say it. Then we'll call it a morning, potentially. In those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin year by year, for it's impossible for the blood of bulls and the blood of goats to take away sin. Therefore, when he comes into the world, he's speaking of Christ, when Christ comes into the world, and now he does something really remarkable, the author does, he now reaches back into Psalm 40, David writing messianically, and he quotes this from Psalm 40, sacrifice and offerings you have not desired. Oh, well, this is just fascinating, because this is David who writes in the Psalms that he delights in the law of God. And yet in Psalm 40, he writes that sacrifice and offering is not what delights God. It's exactly what God demands by the law. And yet the man after God's own heart writes that this isn't what God requires. It's not doing it. It's not satisfying God. It's not finishing or perfecting anybody. So what's the solution? But a body you have prepared for me. Christ speaking in the first person. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you've taken no pleasure. That's almost like rubbing salt in the wound, isn't it? You have these people for 1,400 years bringing this constant flow of blood, bringing all these animals, and then David writes, and God takes pleasure in none of that. None of that. That accomplished nothing for you. You do it. You got to do it. You have to do it. Keep doing it. Don't stop doing it. God is not pleased with it. He's not satisfied by that. It's going to take much more than that to satisfy God. So I said, verse 7, then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it's written about me, and I've come to do your will, O God. That was all the way back in the Psalms. The writer of Hebrews picks it up and says, all the way back in your Psalms, writing again to a Hebrew audience, in your own scripture, David already wrote that there is a physical human body coming. Messiah is going to come physically. He's going to come in a prepared body, and he's going to accomplish what the sacrifices of the blood of bulls and goats could never, ever accomplish. He's going to come and take away sin. He's going to come and do the will of God. And I like that even David, way back there in the Psalms, wrote that in the scroll of the book, it's written about Christ. So even he saw the foreshadow that the sacrifices for sin were casting. They were casting that shadow toward the once-for-all sacrifice. Now we're going to get commentary from the writer of Hebrews on that passage, which is very helpful. I don't have to supply the commentary. He's going to do it. After saying this above, sacrifice and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have not desired, nor have you taken pleasure in them, which were offered according to the law. After he said that, he said this. He said, behold, I have come to do your will. And here's his conclusion. He takes away the first in order to establish the second. He takes away the sacrifice of the blood of the bulls and the goats. He takes away the law. He takes away the old covenant in order to establish the second one. With all the teaching we've been doing on old and new covenant contrasts in the last couple of months, this should ring very familiar to all of you. Here he is yet again saying that when Christ came, he did away with the law. He did away with the old covenant so that he could establish the singularity of the rule and reign of Christ. You don't get to mix and match them. But now he's going to talk about what the will is. Behold, verse 9, he said, behold, I have come to do your will. Verse 10, by this will, the will of God, we have been sanctified. What does the word sanctified mean? Hagiosmos. What is it? It means holy. It's the same word translated saints. It's a word that means to be separated for God's exclusive use. It's the same word in the Old Testament that was used for the furniture or anything that was in the tabernacle. It couldn't be used for any common use once it was sanctified for God's use. We have been sanctified.
By whose will?
By the will of God, we have been sanctified, set apart. Now think about yourself for a moment in that context. If you have been set apart by God for his exclusive use, then you can no longer be used for any common or depraved use. That ought to encourage you toward Christian living. Because after all, you've been set apart by God for his exclusive use. What are you doing acting like that? What are you doing going in those places? What are you doing talking like that or behaving like that? You got no business doing that. You're sanctified. You've been set apart by God for his exclusive use. But now follow the logic. This is brilliant logic. I'm nearly done, I promise. I'm building to an important point here. By the will of God, by this will, we've been sanctified by the offering of the body of Jesus Christ. Hapax, once for all, say some of your translations. It's a one-time and one-only-time sacrifice. That single sacrifice sanctified us. Verse 11 says, every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices, which can never take away sin. But he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, this once for all thing, one time, one sacrifice, one time finished, he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down at the right hand of God. This has two very important meanings. I'm really moving quickly now. It's two very important meanings. One thing that the Old Testament priests, Old Covenant priests, could never do, they could never sit down. They had to work. If they were in the tabernacle, they were working. Think about all the furniture that's in the tabernacle. Every piece of furniture in the tabernacle requires standing up. There are no chairs, there are no stools, no sofas, no lazy boy, no recliner, no love seats. No, there's no place to sit down anywhere in the tabernacle, because if you're in the tabernacle in front of God, you're working. Because the work has to keep going, and the sacrifice has to keep going. The blood has to keep flowing. The work has to keep going. Jesus, sacrifice, one time, finished, sat down. Isn't that wonderful? That's how finished it is. Hapax, once for all, done. But where did he sit down? The right hand of God, the place of majesty and authority. He sat down at the right hand of God. The writer of Hebrews already told us the reason he's there at the right hand of God is that he's ever living to make intercession for us. Our high priest, who is also referred to as our advocate. When we sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. That's the word for lawyer, the one who pleads your case. Our lawyer, our advocate, our high priest is seated right there next to God for you. This is good news.
Yes, it is.
Because remember I told you, you're perfect. We asked Russ if he felt perfect. Russ said, no, he didn't feel perfect. Nevertheless, in those places where Russ messes up, and I'm assuming he still does, in those places where he messes up, he has an advocate with the Father who ever lives to intercede for him. So that even in those places where he makes a mess of things, his advocate can say, I paid for that. He's forgiven. I took care of that. I solved that problem. He's forgiven. And nobody can lay any charge against God's elect, writes Paul in Romans 8. Why can nobody lay any charge against God's elect? Because, according to Paul in Romans 8, because it's Christ that died, yea, that is risen again. It's God that justified those people. So if it's God that's justifying, if it's Christ that did the sacrificial work and then rose again and then God accepted that sacrifice, there's nothing, anyone, no devil, no angel, no human, not your worst enemy, no one can charge you with anything in the court of heaven and make it stick because your lawyer is sitting at his right hand constantly advocating for you and interceding for you in those places where you were wrong. You are saved. You're as saved people can saved be saved, saved. You're so saved. You are way saved. You are saved to the uttermost. You are safe. You're safe. I said all that to get to verse 14. Literally. He's sitting at the right hand of God waiting from that time on forward until his enemies be made a footstool for his feet. For by his one offering, hapax, he has perfected for all time the ones that he sanctified. So when he died, he sanctified certain people, set them apart for his own personal use. And by that one single sacrifice, he perfected them forever and did what the law could never do. He forgave them. This is such good news.
Yes, it is.
Now, all of that was introduction for next week. Because the writer of Hebrews isn't done. I'm just out of time. But he's going to continue building the argument from there. Do you see how logical the argument is? And it just builds point by point by point by point. And he's going to continue building from there. And we've got to spend a little time talking about the eschatological significance of the phrase that he's sitting at the right hand until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. Because the chances of us ever being back there again anytime soon are pretty slim, so we'll start there next week and talk about that. But if you come away with nothing else today, you may not remember anything, but he wrote a Greek word on the board and he talked a lot. If you come away with nothing else, come away with this. Run to Christ, him alone, and do what the writer of Hebrews said last week. Renew your conscience from this love that we all have of dead works. Your works can't save you, won't save you, can't help you. But the single sacrifice of Christ, done once for all and finished, cleanses your conscience not only from dead works, but cleanses your conscience from the fear, the dread fear of sin and judgment. And you can be okay before God. And if you've got that, you're going to be okay in every other aspect of your life. Yeah?
Yes.
Good.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.